Let me introduce our speakers. Kevin Wood. He's a partner and a member of the Winstead's Healthcare Industry Group. He guides all types of healthcare providers in navigating the complex and ever-changing rules that control how they do business. He and his team help providers find practical solutions to meet and overcome those challenges. Kevin and his team recently left another firm to join Winstead. On a side note, Kevin is a dear friend, and he is responsible for us expanding Healthcare Think Tank beyond San Antonio into Austin, Houston, and Dallas-Fort Worth. So thank you, Kevin, or curse you, Kevin, whatever the case may be.
It's my life.
Dr. Ramon Coronado, he's the director and founder of Crown Scientific. We had Ramon as our speaker a couple of weeks ago, and we fell in love with Ramon. He is a great guy. He is a scientist specializing in cell and biologic therapeutics, from basic research to clinical. His conference topic the other day was stem cell treatment without cells, which is very interesting. And it was a fascinating program. He will participate with Kevin as he constantly deals with the complexities of developing new medical treatments and all that goes into doing that. That's working with the FDA, all sorts of stuff. So with that, I hand it over to you guys.
Great. Thanks, Linda. And thanks, Ramon, for joining me today. It's been great getting to talk with you and getting to know you better. I will echo what Malcolm said earlier. Whenever I do this, even though we're talking virtually today, whenever I give presentations, I like to have a dialogue. So please, 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 if you have the opportunity or if you have a question come up while we're on a specific slide or topic, please feel free to interrupt at that time. I asked the same, and Malcolm said Ramon will be doing this too. He's going to be looking at the chat box, but he and I have talked, and he is much more on the ground, as Linda says, with respect to these types of issues. And I've asked him to definitely pipe in when we get to appropriate moments to give kind of some practical perspective on what we're looking at today. As Linda said in the invitation too, what we're looking at and what she kept finding out as she had these Zoom calls with respect to COVID-19 and what was happening, where were we going, is folks kept asking, well, why can we not get a cure? Why can we not get a vaccination very quickly? What's going on? 12 to 18 months is what everyone's talking about with respect to a vaccination, for example, and that seems like a long time. Well, actually, what we'll find as we go through the talk today and learn on the process is 12 to 18 months for a vaccination is lightning speed. With respect to the various components that have to be done in the development and implementation of a vaccine and the testing and safety of that vaccine. So what we'll do today is go quickly through a whole lot of topics and items, and you will definitely see that how do we get to a quick cure while maintaining regulatory compliance is definitely complicated. Malcolm, if you'll go ahead to the next slide. And of course, Linda mentioned I'm a shareholder with Winstead PC, and no legal conversation can be good without a disclaimer. So here's today's disclaimer. I was actually on a health law section meeting just a minute ago, and they had a similar disclaimer with the Texas Hospital Association. And nothing we're going to talk to about today is legal advice. These are very complex matters. The rules and regulations, to the extent you know or plan to do anything with respect in today's discussion dealing with a vaccine, but in any other type of healthcare setting, please seek professional counsel for that. We obviously, as healthcare lawyers, are able to help, but there are lots of great consultants and other vendors out there who can help with your issues. Next slide. Well, and why are we here today? Well, we're here today to talk about how can we move past another way of how we can move past the coronavirus and COVID-19. And as we're gonna focus a lot on the vaccination component, because you hear in the news every day about herd immunity and how we have to get to a herd immunity with respect to being able to get back to some sort of new normal. And that means, for example, a host of testing. I mean, significant testing and contact tracing. It means a host of other treatments for folks who are actually confirmed with the disease. And it means moving to and getting to a vaccination. But kind of really what I wanted to show with this slide was a context of where we are with respect to COVID-19. And you'll see those numbers there were dated yesterday. We were right at a million, right a little less than a million of confirmed COVID-19 cases. I checked a little bit before today's talk and that has now gone over a million. We gained about 57,000 or so new COVID cases between 1 o'clock yesterday afternoon and 1 o'clock this afternoon. So we've done that. You'll see there deaths at this moment are shown around 56,000 and the recovered numbers. But in contrast, I wanted to show that against another regular virus that we deal with on an annual basis and deal with on a vaccine that is recommended for most, if not all adults to get, several children to get, and that's the influenza vaccine. And if you look there, these CDC estimates, and I have to emphasize these are estimates because there's no really testing for flu unless you show up to a doctor visit and get tested or show up to the hospital. But instead what CDC does is takes the surveillance data they have for the flu and extrapolates out what they think the burden of the flu season is. And you can see there that they estimated from October to April, so over the 6 month period that was the flu season, we had anywhere from 40 to 56 million individuals who had the flu. We had 18 to 26 million related medical visits, hundreds of thousands of hospitalizations. And then what was very surprising to me in this is that we had, they estimate 24 to 62,000 flu-related deaths. Again, this is in the U.S. alone, but if you'll note there, the range of flu deaths is encompassing of the range right now of COVID-19 deaths. And we're looking at a number of confirmed diagnoses that are much lower. Now, I'm not saying we should extrapolate out of a much higher contagion or a much higher incidence of death, because I think you've also heard in the news that number probably of confirmed COVID-19 cases is vastly understated. We don't have significant testing. We don't know for sure who may or may not have been exposed. But this is really just to show the difference between a new pandemic that's kind of taking over and then another virus that we deal with on an annual basis and have lots of education and, quite frankly, vaccinations in the hundreds of millions. The U.S., for example, produces around 170 to 180 million vaccination ampules every year. And so you've got to see from where we get to zero vaccinations to 180 is going to have quite a few steps. And we'll go to the next slide, please, Malcolm. Thanks. And as we get ready, you know, we're talking a lot about how can we get to a new normal? Well, we have to get to a lot of great and effective medical countermeasures for COVID-19. One is a very simple one, and that's really dealing with testing and contact tracing with respect to the disease. And we, at this moment, I checked a little earlier today, approximately 5.6 million tests have been provided for COVID-19 at the moment. And out of 327 million Americans, that's only about 1.7% of the population. And the testing right now, pretty much, as we all know from the news, and if you've seen videos, is from a nasal swab. And we're very much trying to move to an antibody testing. Apparently, one has been approved very recently. I saw a headline, and this is just a headline, so I don't have the details, but Quest, which is a large lab company, has a antibody test that they're going to start pushing that would be different from the nasal swab because the antibody test is actually a blood based test that will tell who's had the disease and had hopefully some immunity to it in helping us get a better contact, a better concept of who's had it and where is the immunity at the moment. Again, it still requires appropriate tracing and components for that. Another medical countermeasure that is in development will be what is called recombinant antibodies. And that's really an early intervention upon exposure or infection. And it's akin to early treatments, for example, and this is, they're not the same, but you know, it was the easiest analogy. So when folks fear they're exposed to HIV, they can go to the hospital or the doctor and get an antibody very quick that would minimize or prevent further infection. And so that's another, that's the type of antibody that we're talking about there. Another medical countermeasure that is in the news a lot is the in-course treatment, and not what works as an antiviral drug for COVID-19. And that's when you're severely ill or you do have the infection, and drugs that can help lessen the symptoms or shorten the course of the disease. And then finally, what we're going to really talk about today, and I wanted to educate the folks on today of why it takes so long to get to a vaccine, and that's the preventive piece. And how can we get to a vaccine such that we can all be inoculated and hopefully prevent or minimize the incidence of disease in the population? And I see Ramon raise his hand.
Yeah, Kevin, I get a lot of questions as a scientist, a lot of people, friends or family members, is like, hey, everyone's of course hoping for a vaccine. I think that's one of the hot topics. Like, hey, we're gonna finally be able to go out when vaccines are available. And there's a lot of pressure in the scientific community to be like, why are you guys not working on a vaccine? Can you explain a little bit more about why it's not a matter, or if it's a matter of getting the best vaccine that works? I mean, because you hear about, hey, there's 10, 12 companies or 60 companies working on a vaccine. Why there's so many? And then isn't supposed to be the one that actually has a vaccine that works enough, and why they're still competing? Can you comment on that?
Sure, we're gonna get to that. That's an excellent question. And then we definitely have some materials for that. So let's go on, because we'll get to that in a future slide. Malcolm, next slide. Excellent, thank you. And it's amazing, by the way, when you start to learn on a topic and start researching a topic, what you have on the internet. You have to kind of look at it a little bit of what's real and what's not. But I found this slide and this graphic to be very insightful with respect to a vaccine, because it shows here timelines. I mean, we're looking pre-1900 to the present day, so 150 years or so of looking at a multitude of diseases that we're trying to get vaccines for. I mean, you'll see there, obviously, influenza. We just talked about the incidence of flu in the United States. You'll see there whooping cough, polio, measles, mumps, rubella, some things that are common that we do and often see with vaccination in children, but some others that you get vaccinated for when you're traveling to other countries. What's interesting to me to show there on this is the context of, look how long some of those were in development, and look how long of some of those took to get to an effective stage. Pneumococcus, for example, was 100 years or more. Influenza was lots of years from the early 20th century to the mid 20th century to get, by the way, you notice there it's in gold because it's only partially effective. Every year in the flu season, while we have lots of vaccinations, only about 50 to 60% of the population get covered by that vaccine for it to work. So that's even another component to a vaccine for COVID-19. That comes into play. And then I'll finally note too, you'll see there a red bar for the Ebola virus. This obviously, this graphic was done pre-November or so of 2019, because there is an approved Ebola virus vaccine as of November 19 in the EU. It was quickly adopted and accepted by the World Health Organization, and then also approved by the FDA for the United States in December of 2019. But to Ramon's point, for example, that is only one vaccination that is approved. There are 10 to 12 other Ebola vaccines that are in current testing for other versions of the virus. So it's important to keep in mind that even though you might have the one that's approved and is very appropriate for the disease, there are a number of others that could still be in development for other components of the disease. Next slide, please. And this is, just so we know, till we get to the point where we kind of talk about the hurdles, I wanted to provide some more context in the graphics, because it was much easier to do than bullet points. You'll see here two different graphics that kind of talk about the progression of a vaccine from development to implementation. If you look at the one there on the left of the screen, the journey of your child's vaccine is actually a graphic from the FDA. And it talks about how the Food and Drug Administration gets to the vaccines that most of our children have had in their lives. I'm not going to get into the political ramifications. I know there, when we talk about that in a minute, there are lots of people who are also anti-vaccine. And so this is a component, but this is not to talk about that. This is really just to really show you how we get there. And you'll see both graphics actually walk through a phase one, a phase two, a phase three, where you're actually getting more and more test subjects to determine, is the vaccine safe? Is it effective? What are the most common side effects? And I think those are the things we need to keep in mind, the two pillars of a vaccine. One, is it safe? And two, is it effective? And each step in this progression is to help make sure that that's the case. I also like the one on the right side from Vox, because it actually goes to pre-phase testing. So it talks about the bit of the timeline for vaccines that are done in pre-human testing. We all don't necessarily like to think about animal testing, but it is a fact and it is part of the process. And we have example in San Antonio. We have Texas Biomedical Research Institute, Texas Biomed, that has a large animal testing component, very effective. They actually have recently gotten around a $3 million funding for the testing of specific COVID-19 options for a vaccine. And so we have players in the direct area of healthcare think tank that can be leaders in this. And I think the important thing that we can be encouraged by this group is we have leaders like Texas Biomed and Crown Science that Ramon is with, and University Health System, who talked to us the other day, who have the opportunities and the abilities to have test subjects and work on that. But the importance to me of the Vox diagram is to show the length of time for each of those components. You have, for a drug discovery and determining if a vaccine or a pharmaceutical drug is appropriate for a vaccine, look at that. On average, it takes 3.5 years of animal testing to get to where we feel like it's safe for human testing. The first phase one can take up to a year with a relatively small number of people. Phase two, which gets a little more and you get a little more volunteers and you look at immune systems more effectively, that can take up to another 2 years. And then finally, the phase three, which includes the biggest testing, which is thousands of patients, could take 3 years with another 2.5 years tacked on for FDA review. So you can see there, just on an average, an approximate year from lab to pharmacy for a vaccine is 12 years. Costs are $100 million to $1 billion, which I know I don't have in my wallet, and I'm pretty sure most of us on the phone call don't have readily available, but you've got to figure out how that funding is there. And then, another comment to Ramon's question. Look at that success rate. 5 of 5,000 compounds reach human testing on average. And of those 5, only 1 ultimately gets approved on average. So the numbers, that's a 1/1,000th even of a compound gets to human testing, and then only 1 of those on average gets approved. And Malcolm, if you'll go on the next slide for me, please. Thanks. And this is, Ramon, I see your question.
Quickly, Kevin, something that is also important, I think, to mention is, we all kind of familiar with the concept of, okay, we need to do a clinical trial, and then when you're trying to fix a disease, imagine how that looks like in terms of patients. You have someone already sick coming to the clinic, and now you're going to give them the option. Hey, you want this drug or do you want to be part of the study? So it's a more clear cut. Imagine in terms of prevention, how does that look like in terms of being a volunteer and having people sign up? Hey, I'm going to inject you with something that could eventually prevent you from getting the disease, and we have to monitor you or give you the disease to see if you're actually going to be fighting it or not. So getting those volunteers is very hard, and the prevention component on the study of the clinical trial is much more complex than trying to fix it with the anti-inflammatory or the hydroxychloroquine, which is being used right now. Because at that moment, you already have the disease. So they're giving you an opportunity to get better. But a vaccine is like, you're healthy. Let me give you this vaccine and let's monitor you until you get exposure to the virus. That's very costly and it's very hard to manage in terms of clinical trials. So it becomes very, very expensive.
No, that's a great comment. Thank you, Ramon, for adding that, because that's a very great practical context to the process. And it shows, it kind of shows on this graphic that now is on the screen, that same thing. Every step of the way, you have to ask the question of, is the product safe? Is what we're injecting into human beings? These are real live individuals. And like Ramon says, they have volunteered for this process. This is not someone who's sick. This is someone who may be worried about it, but it's someone who has decided, I'm willing to be tested. And in a lot of cases, by the way, not only some of them maybe are going to be tested with the actual pharmaceutical drug, the compound, some are going to be tested with a placebo of instead of the compound. You're not going to know which. They're having to sign off on a lot of things, and I'm not even going to get into the legal ramifications of what happens if something goes bad, because that's another issue with respect to this. But you'll see each step of the way, you're looking at, is it safe? Is there an immune response? What is the level of that immune response, and what dosage is the best dosage to get to that immune response? And then finally, the largest group in phase three being, does it work? If you'll go to the next slide too, Malcolm, it kind of talks about the process, and like Ramon was saying, it's very costly, but if you'll also see, this is kind of the current strategy of how you get to a vaccine, and the current strategy at the very top is an egg-based approach. You take an egg, and this is very much outside the realm of my understanding. Ramon, I know, can talk a lot more in detail about this than I can, but they're developing it, and it takes a lot of time. It's a slow manufacturing process. With respect to the flu vaccine, for example, you have to know estimate what the prevalent virus is going to be. You have to have tested it. You have to test the vaccine against the immunity properties for that virus. And you get variable protection season to season from that. You can see as this goes down, one reason I like this slide is it shows the areas that you finally get to the bottom where it's next generation development, and you're not really using a live virus. So you're not potentially... You're trying to develop ways that you're not delivering a live virus that can make somebody sick, but you're instead trying to develop an immune response. But you're getting those individuals who are having to make that decision on their own. And we're still far away from that. My understanding as I look at this, and maybe Ramon can speak to this, is we're much closer to the top part of the chart there than looking at any type of peptide-based approaches or nucleic acid-based approaches.
So just to comment on that one, for those who are not familiar in the field, the essence of a vaccination is essentially imagine your immune system being soldiers. They're protecting your body against foreign things. So if, let's say, COVID-19 is the enemy, it just populates too fast for your body to react. So what you want to do is give them a dead enemy so they can get familiar with how they look like, how they smell, how to be recognized, where do they hide. So whenever you have a living organism coming in, you're ready to battle. You already have the army figured out. You have your components in place for going and fighting. So scientifically, you have proof of concept in the technology because it gets very expensive to manufacture. Imagine I have to do vaccines for 100 people. It might cost me $500,000. Now, that's a proof of concept. Once you start scaling up, you move to different technologies that make it cheaper. So you have to start somewhere, and then also you have to have considerations of, let's say you create a lot of viruses within eggs, chicken eggs, and then you get to the point where like, well, there's some people who are allergic to components of the eggs, so you have to clean it well. Then you go, well, let's do it in other cells types, and the efficiencies change, the cost will change. So those are considerations that is not only in the scientific point of view, but also on the business sustainability point of view. When you have to do 100 million vaccines to support the demand, then now you're talking about millions of dollars that you might not have available at that point, and it might be too much risk to invest because you haven't proven yet what you need to do at that stage. But all of those considerations have to be applied early on, and all the components have to be in place. So yeah, I agree that we're more in the current strategy, proof of concept. There's some of them that already have, the big pharma, for example, get the advantage of having manufacturing in place. So it's much faster to deploy things from the idea and the concept to the availability of the compound. So I think that's why a lot of big pharmas are always in the top of the race, because they have all the ducks in place in a row for executing.
Excellent. Thanks for that, Ramon. That's very helpful. We'll go to the next slide, because that really is a great segue into some hurdles of getting to a vaccine. And these are just kind of what I have seen as like the big hurdles. We have some components on here. I didn't even talk about the volunteer aspect of a clinical trial for the subject individuals, and what they have to waive and what they have to agree to, and the legal ramifications of all of that. The data privacy, the healthcare privacy components of what they have to agree to for the sharing of data that's applicable to a health condition, and how that comes into play. And that's across the gamut of any type of treatment testing. And then we also have kind of, I just realized I do not have this on silent in my office, so that is a little embarrassing. Lesson one from Malcolm. But you'll see here kind of, let's talk through each of these. And the big one with respect to a vaccine is the regulatory framework. And you'll see there, we're talking about it's been declared a global pandemic. COVID-19 is affecting the world, some in much stronger instances than others. But when we're looking at a vaccine, for example, it is not just the United States that Big Pharma might have to answer to. They have regulatory bodies in the European Union. China has its own regulatory components. Anything that is done on an international scale then looks at the World Health Organization and approval there. In the United States, we have the Food and Drug Administration and CDC that are all involved in that. And so you have a multitude of requirements, and I know this will be shocking for everyone on the phone to hear, but the EU and China and the FDA don't necessarily agree on what the requirements are to get to a final product and the safety and efficacy, and not only that, of what you can include as a component of the product. There are differences between an active pharmaceutical ingredient, which is the important component to get to a treatment, and the non-active ingredients or the secondary ingredients in a compound that can have a host of effects absent just the drug component that we're looking at with respect to a vaccine or treatment. And each of those regulatory bodies see it in a little different way. The good thing, and what we've seen a lot of use of recently, are emergency use authorizations. And we've heard a lot about that in the news with respect to personal protective equipment, PPE, and emergency use authorizations that the FDA has put into place to get those into the hands of hospital and healthcare workers in a faster pace. It is likely that any vaccine or other therapeutic for COVID-19 will get developed with some sort of emergency use authorization to help short circuit the process. But as you can see from what we've seen already, the likelihood of that being super short is pretty small. The big hurdle that is not really legal or anything else, it's just the requirement of there, and I probably should have listed it first, but it's safety and efficacy. It is immaterial if a drug works, if it is not safe, or if it is not effective, and those are paramount components to it. We've talked a bit about cost. That is not an insignificant hurdle. Flu, for example, is estimated to be a $1.6 billion venture every year. And so we've got to think through that and how that's done. Which leads into politics and funding. I know it's also probably no news to anyone on this call that the agreement of our own legislators in Washington does not necessarily come down in a line in a unified way on this. Adding to this is the fact that China is the epicenter of the disease. It is where it began, so we all think and have been told. Evidence seems to indicate that. But on top of all this is earlier this year and late last year, the current administration decided they wanted to implement some sort of a trade war with China and implement tariffs and those types of things. So, you know, have to keep in mind, is this a new arms race? How does that impact things for China as a source of materials for any vaccine or treatment? Or how does it impact China as a source for manufacturing? Ramon also talked about this a little bit. You have a manufacturing scale-up issue. It's much easier, and Big Pharma probably has a leg up on this, but they probably have manufacturing, so they can take care of the components for a phase 1, 2, or 3 trial, which you're talking about 3,000 to 5,000 individuals. You have to be thinking ahead and at the beginning of the process of how you can manufacture and scale up to hundreds of millions of product. And then you, on top of that, you have to be thinking ahead to that next stage of how are you going to prioritize and distribute that product. I think it's important to note most likely what will happen through this process is when we get to a vaccine and even manufacturing begins, you will see periodic distribution and priority given to potentially compromised individuals, especially susceptible populations, healthcare workers, and others who might be on the front line of being exposed to the disease before we get to a mass production or distribution to the population as a whole. But with that in mind, and I know we've taken a lot of time and hopefully have a few minutes left for questions, but that probably gives us enough to noodle on. Wow, everybody's dumbstruck, awestruck.
It's so much information, Kevin, and I know that everybody wants answers because we live in this society where we get instant gratification. So thank you for the insight on, and I really liked the graph on how long it has taken for us to come up with the vaccines for all the things that we deal with. That was incredibly interesting.
Well, thanks. And very, I think I'm glad for that. And I think it's important. We do live in an instant society. Everything we can pull up, if we have a question, we can pull it up on our phone and get an instant answer. I saw a conversation or a commercial or whatever it was that, you know, 30 years ago, 20 years ago, somebody asked a question, they didn't know the answer, they moved on. And they went on to the next topic of conversation. Nowadays, what you do is you ask a question and they say, oh, I don't know, let me look it up. And you get to the answer. Unfortunately, we have lots of great people working toward the answer, but this was one of those that is, in quite frank terms, a year to a year and a half is going to be a pretty instant answer if we can get there.
Another thing that I feel it's useful for even us as a society that we can help is like when you have projects of that dimension, it takes a lot of communication, a lot of team players, a lot of collaboration. So sometimes you might not think that that is possible for you to help in any ways, but actually it's possible because connecting people who are active in that field might actually help them. Imagine even if you have a technology, the government, the lobbying in DC, from the manufacturing partners, from the money funding agencies, from capital investment, all of that is required. So as a society, we have a big influence on it by promoting partnerships and collaborations to make that happen, because it requires massive teams of people to just get to every single step. Kevin, there's a question that says, how much of current vaccine development based on SARS vaccine development from 2002 and 2003?
I hope you know the answer to that.
I don't know. I know there's a
look it up.
Equivalent And I think the more vaccines are done on top of the other one, you make the process a little bit faster. But what it's still the testing and the clinical trial that takes the longest. So the SARS vaccine and that development that happened probably move forward the manufacturing components, the packages that you have to deliver to the FDA for them to feel confident that what you have is the best that it could be done or it could be traceable. But you still have the delay, even if it's COVID-20 that comes next time. Yeah, we'll have a lot of manufacturing components in place. We'll have a lot of understanding of what a clinical trial should look like, but you still have to go through the whole process all over again. So the efficiency is improved based on those vaccines developed in 2002 and 2003, but you still have to go through the motion of demonstrating that what you have there is suitable. There's another question from Leslie Brennan. What would it take to ramp up development of pharmaceuticals in the US so we become more self-sufficient, moving from development to manufacturing and distributing?
Excellent question. And this is just one sliver of that pie, and it goes back to the question of China and our political relationship with that country. As we've worked on, I mentioned some projects we looked at for PPE. Well, we also, Congress has been looking at this, and for example, 60 to 80% of the active pharmaceutical ingredients that we put in drugs for this country come from China. And they could easily turn off the spigot and keep that from coming here. And what's even more interesting is you have some folks who are talking about, well, let's move to India because the cost is a component and manufacturing and labor costs. So let's move to India and look at it. Well, that doesn't really help because over 95% of the active pharmaceutical ingredients in India come from China. And so just that's not moving anything around. So we would have to figure, this is just one sliver, we'd have to figure out how to bring that back into the United States or in another trading partner that may not be, that may be more amenable to helping us. But that's one piece. We also have to make sure that we have the manufacturing infrastructure. Again, I'll use PPE as an example. You had the federal government telling car auto manufacturers to change their production lines to create these products. And some readily agreed, some did not so readily agree until war emergency powers were called into play. But we have to have that piece too. Where is the manufacturing base and how can we do that? I am not knowledgeable enough to know the details other than those specific components. I know as I looked at this for a vaccine, have to be brought back into the United States or found a way to get to that component. It's going to be multi-years. We can't do it immediately, but it's a great question.
I have a question. Because we are in a rush to get things done, and I realize that there's a lot of competition among the big pharma. And are they working conjunctively together to get this taken care of? Or is there still that deep competition on who's going to own the virus, the vaccine?
Ramon, do you have any insight on that?
Well, I think it's a complicated case because COVID-19, in terms of vaccine, will give you like, there's a lot of capital involvement, so the people who have more capital are more likely to get there. The competition between manufacturers are going to be a distribution of capital, essentially, at the end of the day. Think about COVID-19 not being around in a year. So you spend, let's say, $500 million on this vaccine, yet there's no people, or there's no resurgence of it. What are you going to do with that? How many candidates will have to be selling it every year for how long? So you get one vaccine and you're done and then there's no resurgence of it. So all those components are going to be involved in that race. Some of them might be more interested in some other ones. But in my opinion, the ones that are going to be winning are the ones who have most of the components of the market in place. So the manufacturing, the lobbying, the regulatory advantage. The science, in essence, is more simple. And I think a lot of the pharmas and institutes have the capabilities of coming with a strategy to at least have a candidate. It's just going to be a matter of execution, who's going to win.
And I think they probably are working together more on this type of issue than they would on most. But I think given, you know, the structure of the American economy and how pharmaceutical manufacturers just deal with things and help work to protect their intellectual property, that's only going to go so far. I think if one feels that they have a leg up or an advantage to get to a better product or a more effective vaccine, they're going to take that. They'll be nice with everybody, and I'm sure they will share science with respect to a point, but at some point that's going to break down. And I just, I think probably right now there is a lot of cooperation, but that will change absent outside forces. So absent, for example, a state or the federal government telling manufacturers, we're going to pass legislation, for example, that removes the financial incentive. I think that's unlikely, or not necessarily remove the financial incentive, but say you have to cooperate. This is the profit margin and the profit incentive is not as important as getting to the right answer. And until that kind of intervention comes, the cooperation is probably not going to be as good as we would hope.
Any other questions? There's...
I was typing, so I thought I'd just ask, I'll come off mute and just ask a question. I saw a proposal last September for having the Department of Defense purchase all of its medications for active duty retirees and so forth from U.S. sources. Do you think that might be a good start to incentivize American manufacturers, pharma, to do it? Otherwise, they're fighting tariff battles.
Sure. I think any type of outside intervention is what it's going to take to move to that. Otherwise, while government or private sector, either one, is going to drive to what's the most economical component for the company. And I think if you have a sector of the government, especially something like DOD, could do that. Again, political hurdles of getting to that point in reality at the end of the day. But great question.
The other thing that I think is going to change dramatically the landscape moving forward, and that could be from a cultural point of view in terms of China. So the majority of the reagents and things like that, they're cheaper in China. The trials are cheaper to do there. But I think that the American culture is going to be shifting drastically after this, and hopefully for the better in terms of manufacturing. I mean, even if you have the opportunity to buy face mask from China for $1 versus American made for $1.20, you're already being like, you know what, I'm going to purchase it from here, the economy here. And I think medicine and research and the collaborations are going to get a little bit more tight when it comes into the nation. So this might be an opportunity for us to know how to play with each other better. And I see that as a very optimistic thing, because we can, if we want to, and the government has the potential. Going to back to Leslie's question, is the government has a big influence to make that happen, because they can have a lot of incentives, financial incentives, also regulatory, to create consortiums, for example. Instead of giving these grants for this absurd amount of money to only one company, we're going to require to have five institutions collaborating, or things along those lines. They can really help the medical system or the discovery system in the nation. So things are gonna, in my opinion, are gonna change in how medicine is pursued or research, especially clinical research, and I hope it's for the best.
Okay. All right. Our time is up right now. Let's hope for the best, and let's hope that, you know, there's still a lot of talk about this, the resurgence of COVID-19. Next fall, and we have to hope that that doesn't happen or we're in a pickle again. But this was great. Thank you so much, Kevin and Ramon, for this, for enlightening us on what we have to look forward to. It was a brilliant presentation, And hopefully you all will join us on Thursday. Have a good rest of Tuesday and tomorrow, and we'll see you then Thursday. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Glad to do it.
Thank you.
Thanks, everyone. Bye-bye.